From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. And on this day, Governor Paul LePage says he expects the buyer of Fairchild Semiconductor to shut down the South Portland plant, which employs hundreds of workers. University of Maine system officials say they plan to ask lawmakers for a 12% hike in state funding. And we continue our series on legalizing recreational marijuana with a look at how Maine's proposed law differs from the law Colorado enacted 2 years ago. Those stories and more after this. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caridi. Governor Paul LePage and Maine Attorney General Janet Mills are at odds once again. The governor has joined a lawsuit filed by several states in federal court seeking to block new overtime rules. But Mills says the state of Maine is not joining that suit.
The governor is free to join in his individual capacity, but not on behalf of the state of Maine. Unfortunately, adding the label governor of the state of Maine implies to people that he's representing the state of Maine. That's not the case.
In a statement, the governor says the new rules will require more state workers to be paid overtime. The court complaint says the rules will affect about 450 workers, but Mills says she has no way of knowing whether the numbers cited in the court complaint are accurate. She says her office was not notified of the governor's move. Mills says only her office can commit the state to any legal action. The governor, meanwhile, offered a grim prediction today for the roughly 650 employees at the recently purchased Fairchild Semiconductor. The governor told Bangor radio station WVOM that he believes the company's new owner, ON Semiconductor, would shutter the South Portland facility.
The likelihood of them leaving, I think, is unfortunate, is a high probability, and unfortunately, it falls on deaf ears across the street.
LePage said Maine's high energy prices would likely force the company to leave. He then blamed the legislature for not enacting his various energy proposals, although there's strong disagreement among policymakers whether the governor's policies would do anything to help. Also, the legislature 3 years ago passed a sweeping energy bill designed to increase natural gas capacity, a move intended to help big energy users like Fairchild control costs. LePage also said that Fairchild was the mystery company that he said back in April would lay off hundreds of workers and leave the state. The governor today also weighed in on Bath Iron Works' loss of a $10.5 billion contract to build a new generation of cutters for the Coast Guard. LePage said he was hopeful that the setback is temporary and that the state's fourth largest employer is in a better position for the next bid.
It's a blow, but we must remember that they, you know, BIW was trying to get into a new market. They're not the primary Coast Guard supplier, not like they are for the Navy.
BIW confirmed last week that it lost the bid to Eastern Shipbuilding in Panama City, Florida. The initial contract is for 9 offshore patrol cutters. The Coast Guard will reopen bids for a 10th cutter, but not until 2024. In a memo to employees, BIW President Fred Harris said the company's bid was too high and that the shipyard needed to become flexible and efficient. Harris previously stated that the loss of the contract would result in layoffs of up to 1,000 workers. Despite the concerns about those two big employers, there were no major changes to Maine's unemployment rate in August. That's according to new numbers from the Maine Department of Labor. State labor officials say unemployment rose slightly from July to August, from 3.9 to 4%. A year ago, the rate was 4.3%. Meanwhile, payroll numbers, which show the number of jobs in a given area, are up from a year ago. Private sector jobs were up, mainly in retail, finance, education, healthcare, professional and business services, and hospitality. Government jobs were down. But when it comes to economic growth, the news for Maine's major metropolitan areas is mixed, according to new numbers out today from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis. Of the three metro areas in Maine that the Bureau tracks, the Portland-South Portland area saw the most growth. Its gross domestic product grew 1.4% from $27.8 billion in 2014 to $28.9 billion in 2015. Bangor's economy also grew, though by less, 1%. But it was a different story in the Lewiston-Auburn area, where GDP shrank by 2.8%. Meanwhile, the University of Maine Systems Board of Trustees plans to ask lawmakers for a 12% increase in state funding over the current budget cycle. The system's communications director, Dan Demerit, said the trustees decided to seek the increase over a three-year period during their board meeting Monday in Fort Kent to address a variety of funding needs.
That includes CPI increases in the state allocation in support of public higher education in Maine. It includes additional funding to support our early college initiatives, where we work with more than half of Maine's high schools to produce college programming in Maine's secondary schools, and also more scholarship funds to help reach adult learners who have some college credit but haven't yet earned their degree, and we want to get them back into the classroom.
Chancellor James Page told trustees that after a period of austerity, the phased-in increases would signify an investment in the system's mission. Demerit said if approved, the total state appropriation to the system would increase from $200 million in 2016 to $225 million in 2019. And a new report finds that Maine's forest products industry still supports more than 33,000 direct and indirect jobs and will contribute about $8.5 billion to the state's economy this year, despite recent job losses and mill closures. The report, by an assistant University of Maine professor, was presented at the Maine Forest Products Council's annual meeting on Monday. It shows that the industry's overall economic impact dropped by about $1 billion between 2014 and 2016, but it's no worse off than it was in 2011. Executive Director Patrick Strauch says he's encouraged by the findings.
I think it's important for people to realize we're still making a huge contribution to the economy of Maine, and we're already seeing the mills that we have left responding in different ways to become more competitive and to put in more capital investment into their operation.
According to the report, Maine had more than 17,000 jobs directly related to the forest products industry in 2011. Today, that number has shrunk to 14,500. Strauch says most of the job losses and mill closures were in the Penobscot River Valley, where facilities were smaller and required more investment. He says the next step is to plot a roadmap for the industry to grow. And you can read that entire report on our website, mpbn.net. Meanwhile, there's a bit of good news for Maine's wild blueberry industry. This year's crop was better than expected, despite the drought that's hit some sectors of New England agriculture hard. Maine Wild Blueberry Commission Executive Director Nancy McBrady says the state has most likely hit its five-year average of about 93 million pounds. McBrady says irrigation and a strong year for pollination boosted this year's crop. Maine produces far more wild blueberries than any other state in the U.S. Prices have been somewhat low in recent years, as the industry has struggled with oversupply and competition from Canada, where the dollar is weak. That's meant that prices of wild blueberries produced in some eastern Canadian provinces have been lower recently than American blueberries. Coming up, how does Maine's proposed law that would legalize recreational marijuana differ from Colorado's two-year-old law? We take a look. Down in Washington, congressional leaders are trying to wrap up a spending bill to keep the federal government operating until December 9th. But Maine's 1st District Representative, Democrat Shelley Pingree, says what lawmakers should be doing is trying to craft a budget for the entire year and pass it by the October 1st deadline. Mal Leary has more.
Congresswoman Pingree serves on the House Appropriations Committee and says the panel could reach agreement on a budget if House Republican leaders would have made that a priority instead of a long summer break. She says the attempt to get a continuing resolution passed by the weekend is aimed at providing more time for campaigning. She says Congress should instead do their job and work out a budget. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And the Federal Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, has approved a drug to treat Duchenne muscular dystrophy. That's good news for Biddeford resident Brian Denger. Denger says he's ecstatic that the drug eteplirsen might be available for his 22-year-old son Patrick, who has the rare genetic disorder which causes progressive muscle weakness.
It's not a cure. It won't reverse the course of the disease, but it's possible that it could slow the progression so that he can retain things that he is continues to do.
Denger traveled to Maryland last spring to lobby for approval of eteplirsen. The FDA's approval goes against the recommendation of an advisory committee, which found that there's not enough evidence that the drug is effective. The FDA is requiring further trials to confirm the clinical benefit. And now to our series on question one on the November ballot. In planning a framework to allow recreational marijuana sales in Maine, the authors of question one looked to Colorado for inspiration. That state's law is now 2 years old, and there's a baseline of information that can be gleaned from the experiment. Some of it has been copied into Maine's proposed initiative, but there are also some key differences. As we continue our week-long series, High Stakes, How Legalizing Pot Could Affect Maine, A.J. Higgins takes a closer look at what those are.
One of the most important parts of Question 1 is a section that actually gives Maine cities and towns the right to restrict or even prohibit the sale of recreational marijuana. It's a subject that's on the minds of many Maine municipal governing bodies, but few have taken the issue by the horns in the way that the city of Bangor has.
Welcome, everyone, to a workshop of the Bangor City Council. And I just might premise this conversation, because it's really a conversation about what we as a city might do if the marijuana referendum were to pass.
Bangor Mayor Sean Faircloth called a special workshop session of the council last month to raise some of the issues the city should be prepared to address if Maine's referendum passes. Some councilors are anticipating additional revenue from licensing fees, while others want to make sure no one under 21 can get into the marijuana retail sales business. And councilors want to know how Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska's laws are working. Proponents say a lot has been learned, but public health directors, such as Patty Hamilton in Bangor, say Colorado's 2-year experience isn't long enough to be considered a track record.
I feel like we've been rushed into forcing this. Drug policy is rarely made by the people. It's usually made by educated professionals who have the information to compare good, you know, long-term data and studies that really don't exist.
Still, proponents of Question 1 say it's designed to ensure that each community is comfortable with marijuana retail sales. That's why there are strong provisions for local control. In Maine, a municipality can limit the number of retail operations or ban them altogether. Communities could also restrict the hours of operation and require local licensing provisions for retail pot businesses. Jeff Herman of the Maine Municipal Association says Question 1 gives communities considerable discretion.
They can prohibit them altogether. They can regulate them in addition to, supplementarily to, and even more stringently than the state regulatory scheme. It's very strong home rule authority. It's a recognition of that. I notice that the opponents of the initiative think there's some loopholes. Frankly, as far as loopholes go, there aren't too many that I see.
So this potentially would be one of our, where we could have, what we were thinking, possibly make a snack bar kind of thing like that, where you can get some snacks, some drinks, things of that
Justin
nature.
Bragg eyes some of the vacant space at his mainly glass smoking supplies on Hammond Street in Bangor. As manager of a business that serves the medical marijuana community and loose-leaf tobacco smokers, he's trying to maximize profits. He says he hopes to be able to apply for a social club license that is allowed in Maine's ballot question, but overlooked in other states where recreational pot is legal. The city of Bangor could nix the idea of a club that sells marijuana products for on-site consumption, similar to a bar. But Bragg is hoping that won't happen. He thinks it could be popular with customers.
I think it all depends on location, but us here, we'd be more than happy to do something like that as well.
In addition to allowing social clubs, Maine's recreational marijuana proposal stands apart from all four other pot legal states in another big way: how much a person can legally possess. At 2.5 ounces, Maine would allow more than twice the limit of other states which restrict possession to no more than an ounce. David Boyer, of the Pro Question One group known as the Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol, says the comparatively large amount of marijuana for personal use was adopted based on Maine's history for reasons of consistency.
We thought 2.5 ounces made sense, and this is because that is what Maine's decriminalized already, and that's also the allowable possession amount for medical marijuana patients. So we thought, you know, even though they did it that way, that having it consistent for all these medical marijuana decriminalization and legalization, having one number is a lot easier for Mainers and for law enforcement.
Look, 2.5 ounces is a lot of weed, and it's a lot of marijuana. It's about 150 joints worth. It's a lot more than is allowed in any other state.
At his Alexandria, Virginia headquarters, Jeff Zinsmeister runs communications for Smart Approaches to Marijuana, an organization that has emerged as Question One's leading opponent. Zinsmeister says by permitting large amounts of marijuana to be legal for personal use, the law will encourage an underground black market. And Zinsmeister questions claims that black market activity would be lessened by the initiative's relatively low 10% sales tax, arguing that it's still twice as high as the state's sales tax and would create an incentive for illegal sales.
When's the last time you went and bought something from another, from a different store because of a 10% discount? I mean, it's a significant upcharge.
Zinsmeister would prefer Maine impose a higher tax on retail sales, noting that Colorado's is nearly 13%, Oregon's is 25%, and Washington State assigns a 37% point of sale tax. But David Boyer says the 10% tax creates a sort of sweet spot by raising $8 million for the general fund without encouraging illicit sales.
If it's too low, then, I mean, we need to have the funds to pay for the regulation of marijuana to make sure that the businesses are operating, that we can, you know, make sure they're checking IDs and all the stuff that comes with regulating an industry. If we put a, you know, 50% sales tax, then that's just going to increase the cost of marijuana to an amount that's higher than the black market.
Maine's proposed recreational marijuana law also differs from the other four states in that it is the only one to grant regulatory authority to the State Department of Agriculture. Boyer says his group would not be opposed to dividing responsibilities with another state agency, such as the Department of Administrative and Financial Services. But all of these provisions would be subject to the review of the Maine legislature, which will have the final say in implementing the citizen initiative, if it is approved by the voters in November. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
The wind field finally assumes a westerly component, which will gently show our rich moisture the door. While showers end north and clouds gradually vanish, widespread fog will reappear later tonight, dense in some locales, 50s for most, near 60 along the south coast. Fair weather clouds will dot the sky north of Millinocket tomorrow, sunshine quite prevalent for the majority of Maine. 71 north, 82 south, cooler along the coast. Chillier air will settle into the northern third of the state only Thursday, crisp upper 60s. Look for a mix of sun and clouds. Clouds farther south, 70s to mid-80s, warmest interior York County. A cold front will propel showers through and out of the county by noontime Friday, highs only in the upper 50s. Expect a considerable cloud cover to cloak the rest of Maine. Showers mount in central and down east by midday, but not until late Portland south. 60s into the 70s, actually clicking to near 80 in Elliott. The weekend, chilly, very fallish, 50s and 60s statewide. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Steve Missler, A.J. Higgins, Mal Leary, Patty White, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.